From the earliest accounts of man's religious life, sleep phenomena has been associated with oracles. We find evidences of this among practically all primitive peoples, and records, historical and otherwise, have descended from the more advanced culture groups. Sleep was regarded as a magic condition. It was in some ways a suspension of our outer life. The soul, it was assumed, could depart from the body, could visit into remote regions, and ascending through the various orbits of the world, come close to the divine principles at the root of life. Because dream phenomena were so obviously not of this world, it was assumed that there was another world in which dreams were real. And in the ancient Greek art, we have representations of the gate of sleep, leading from the mortal state into a strange temple where shadowy and phantom forms lurked in the gloom or performed weird ritualistic dances around the altars of some ancient deity. It was not, however, in Greek culture alone that sleep gained the strange oracular authority which later came to be associated with it. Sleep was not only natural, but could be induced by artificial means. Very far back, men developed the hypnotic arts, although they did not know them by such a name. They found ways by mesmeristic passes and mesmeric formulas to induce artificial sleep and to throw a subject into a state of somnambulism. At Delphi, the greatest of all the Grecian oracles, a kind of trance or ecstasy was induced by vapors rising from a deep vent in the earth. These vapors had an intoxicating effect. And when the priestess was seated on her tripod over this vent, she inhaled the fumes and passed into a strange, half-sleeping condition. And while in this state, gave forth the oracles or the messages from the deities in the form of hexameter verse. In the ancient grotto of Trophonius, another celebrated oracle of the time, those seeking answers to their questions were conducted down into a cave-like place. Here again, there seems to have been either some natural fume which intoxicated the mind, or possibly those deciding to spend the night there were given drugs to induce visions. Drugs for this purpose are well known. Perhaps the most exciting example being the use of hashish by the sect of the Assassins in Iraq. Here, a very powerful drug brought with it extraordinary ocular hallucinations, causing those who took it to believe that they had been transported into the paradise promised by Muhammad in the Quran. drugs were used by the Druids, and various incenses are frequently referred to. And in one early work, we know that some of the heretical Christian sects of the first few centuries were accused of drugging the communion cup in order to produce ecstasies and trances, during which religious experiences were recorded. In addition to this phase, the sleep phenomena could be affected by fasting and by the general weakening of the body, also by the use of certain foods or exercises or disciplines, producing a curious kind of fatigue. The American Indian induced a form of hypnotic trance by moving an eagle feather back and forth before the eyes of the subject. These trances could also be induced by music, by dance, by various ecstatic forms of ritualism, some of which have descended to us in the excitement and ecstasy of the Holy Rollers and other peculiar groups of Adventists. Thus we see that from an early time, men sought to induce artificial sleep, or in one way or another, to destroy the normal equilibrium of man's objective awareness, casting him into some kind of glamour, either through drugging or through fatiguing the senses. Because in these states, he was held to have a peculiar proximity to spiritual mystery. The motive was quite sincere. It was the only way, however, that these people believed that it was possible to open this door between the worlds and to find some means of retiring into the mystery of the divine root of things, or that other world which was closed to us by the ordinary orientation of our sensory perception. There is a very interesting Japanese fable of two young people in love who attempted to what they called in those days elope into the other world. It's a very curious thought, and of course it ended in suicide. But these lovers were trying to break through again this barrier which divided a condition of being from another condition of being. It was only assumed that the dream world was closely identified with the world of the dead. A man asleep appeared to be dead, but was not really so. Death was a long sleep. Sleep was a little death. St. Paul points this out when he says, "I die daily." This mystery of sleep and the breaking through seems to have affected our psychology and our general attitude toward life, and to have descended subtly to us in a number of our beliefs and superstitions and legends. Now, what does this tell us that may be of immediate importance? The oracular procedures of the Greeks could not have succeeded had the oracles of the Pythian Apollo at Delphi not been, for the most part, true. It is, of course, certain, and this is the out for the modern skeptic, that these oracles were often ambiguous. difficult of interpretation. Obscure until the event actually transpired. But Cicero, gathering a record of these reports, came to the conclusion that the majority of them were wise beyond the wisdom of the world. That there was something about them that transcended the judgment of conscious man. And in many instances, of course, they were amazingly fulfilled to the smallest detail. The reason why the Greek oracles were famous and were consulted by persons in every class of life undoubtedly was the reputation which gradually built around them. This reputation for accuracy has also been mentioned by older writers, and the most grudging have admitted that these oracles were universally constructed, that their recommendations were for the private and public good, that they did contribute a great deal to peace of mind and to the guidance of states and to the direction of leaders. And many of their less fortunate revelations also proved to be true, and warnings which they gave were seldom ignored without disaster. Even Socrates seems to have admired the oracles and to have acknowledged that they represented perhaps one of the deepest sources of man's possible knowledge of life and the world. Many of the oracles were also broadly informative. They brought answers to questions in art, science, religion, philosophy. They assisted in the preservation of crops. They aided the agriculturist in his plans for the harvest. They warned of storms and of pestilences. And it was rather obvious to these people that such information was not normally to be attained in a waking state. Now, the priestesses of Delphi, while selected with the greatest care, were mostly young women, although some reached elder years with great dignity and distinction. These young women were not trained in the worldly pursuits which might have been possible to them in these days. They were virgins of the temple. They lived apart and alone, a cloistered existence. They were not instructed in statecraft or in medicine or in any of these subjects, but were assured that the truthfulness of their revelation depended upon the purity and integrity of their own lives. This, I think, is a further point of interest, and one which will bear consideration. Obviously, the normal state of man can be both naturally and artificially deranged. And among most older people, the insane, the mad, those hopelessly infirm of mind were regarded with a peculiar veneration. They were believed to be very close to God. They were God's own. They did not belong, really, in this world. And it was the responsibility of all to treat them with kindness and to protect them, sometimes even from themselves. But this madness was something like the divine madness, the madness of the Dionysiac cult, induced by the juice of the vine, the intoxication which was held in religious rituals to open these mysterious inferior perceptions, so that, of course, the use of wine in the sacrament, even to this time, originated in this Dionysiac rite, the rite of frenzy, the rite by means of which the individual seemed to suddenly escape from his human limitations and to be able to commune with powers beyond this world and even bring back messages of general interest. Many of the early American Indian tribes also made use of this broad concept. In their case, usually trances were brought on either by hypnotic means or by a form of auto-suggestion. These old medicine priests seem to have been able to cast themselves into trances, more or less at will. And here, in tribal life, they had an unusual opportunity to demonstrate the accuracy of their foreknowledge. They were depended upon in a time when no dependable sciences existed, when laws and codes did very little to protect either the individual or the group. The person who had no rights, no privileges of legal or medical help, who was without any advantages of modern psychology or classical philosophy, built his life very largely upon phenomena. And this phenomena was nearly always associated with sleep mystery and the power of the soul to depart in sleep to explore those things which it most needed to know. Now, we can divide our thinking on this subject into two very broad patterns. The first, and one that is still held by many mystics, is that essentially the old concept was correct, that sleep does mysteriously liberate the soul from the body, or if not a total liberation, at least gives the soul a more positive existence while the body is at rest. East Indian metaphysics intimates this same concept, that the soul can temporarily leave the body and can have adventures and experiences which may later be brought through into remembrance, or partly so, although some elements may evade us or elude us as we return to the waking state. The other broad school affirms that the phenomena of the dream can be rationally explained on a psychological level, that it is not actually that the soul leaves the body, but that the psychic nature comes into a new relationship to the personality during sleep. That in sleep condition, the objective person is in a state of almost complete suspension of animation. In sleep, the outer world loses its power to impress and influence us. In sleep, we appear to be temporarily freed from the burden of even our own opinions. In sleep, a quietude descends upon the mind and the emotions, and they are at rest. This quietude makes possible a man's sensing of deeper phases of his own life. This quietude permits certain currents to seemingly reverse themselves, so that instead of man receiving his principal stimulation from the outside, he suddenly becomes passive and experiences life moving from within himself. That an inner world imposes itself upon the outer, Whereas in the waking state, this imposition from within is made comparatively impossible by the activity of the objective faculty. This is, of course, an essential concept of mysticism. And sleep becomes a kind of stillness, a natural form of mystical experience. In this stillness, the individual becomes acutely receptive. Now, what does he receive into this receptivity? Theoretically, at least, he can receive impressions from around him which might not normally be recorded. Even in sleep, man has certain kinds of awareness. But these are more subtle, dealing with the more sensitive values than those of the waking state. Parapsychology researchers suggest the possibility that in the sleep state, man may attain a certain clairvoyance, a certain at least clairsentience, a telepathic rapport with other persons. In sleep, he may sense more acutely the thoughts of his neighbors, friends, and associates. He may be more responsive intuitively to the temperaments of those around him. In sleep also, he may receive into himself masses of telepathic fragments from the lives and thoughts and emotions of countless persons. These may or may not have any general meaning, but under some conditions, they may also assume prophetic proportions. In this same general area, it becomes quite conceivable that man can attune himself to some kind of record or recording that remains in space around him at all times. We are not sure that space is non-intellectual. We are not sure that the air around us is not a mental atmosphere. We cannot be certain that nature itself does not have its own thinking, and that in a receptive mood we may tune in to these larger thoughts, thoughts which perhaps we can later interpret in genius and great artistry. There seems to be a tendency also for this receptivity to be conditioned by certain major phases of our interest. We know that if we take certain thoughts to sleep, we may have dream experiences relating to these thoughts. We also recognize the age-old custom of taking problems to sleep, with the concept that in the morning we will awaken with the answer. And many have had this experience. We also know that great artists, great musicians and scientists, have generally admitted the importance of sleep phenomena in the advancement of their various abilities. Musicians have heard their melodies in sleep or dreams or trance-like states. Artists have seen the pictures which they would later place upon canvas. Sleep also approximates another state of man, who cultivates a kind of sleep in the discipline of meditation and the various retrospective and contemplative exercises of the Greek theory and of the East Indian school. These meditations are quietude, leading finally perhaps to an almost complete submersion of the personal consciousness in a deep and mysterious ocean of universal values, such as is intimated in the Samadhi of Vedanta. or the mysterious nirvanic trances of the Buddhist arhat. Thus, contemplative discipline bring about again this tendency to detach the mind from the commonplace, from the everyday, and to submerge it more deeply in a tranquility, thus apparently opening the way for a sensitive apperception of things, of energies, of forces, of influences not otherwise immediately noticed. Out of this thinking, whether it be held to be mystical or psychological, we have come to certain practical conclusions. Conclusions which affect the practice of modern psychology and psychiatry to a marked degree. One of the conclusions is that in many instances, sleep phenomena are of valuable aid to the interpretation of the psychic complex of the human personality. That under certain conditions, dreams are not only keys to characteristics, but do constitute a form of admonition, a warning, or an inclination, a kind of instruction by which nature would seek to assist us in immediate understanding of some peculiarity of our own emotion or thought. We know that everywhere nature eternally strives to repair the damage that is caused by human ignorance. If this damage is too great, nature is not equal to the task. But wherever possible, nature sets into action auto-corrective mechanisms to assist us in restoring this equilibrium upon which normalcy and health depend. Thus, as surely as we secure or receive hunches, feelings, we are also inclined to have this awareness of a need for a particular change in conduct or a modification of habits. Many interesting experiences relating to this type of nature's helpfulness have been recorded. An individual, even without sleep, will suddenly become acutely aware of some deficiency in his own nature. He will have a flash of insight which forms a corrective pattern to deliver him from some emergency in which he is in danger of becoming involved. There are many instances of foreknowledge in this department which have caused a person to cancel a trip on a train which was afterwards wrecked, or to not take a certain plane trip when the plane came to disaster. This kind of forewarning or premonition we know because it is testified to by generations of sincere and thoughtful persons. Most of these warnings, however, pass unheeded. We rationalize ourselves out of them. There are numbers of cases also where we record persons who have come to grief as a result of ignoring some kind of intuitional flash which might have saved them. In our daily way of existence, we do not take for granted that this internal insight is legitimate. We do not feel impelled to follow it. If it does not fit into our preconceptions, we ignore it. If it is inconvenient to follow its instructions, we violate them and have certain argumentative procedures by which we justify our own attitudes. This is particularly true in a case of conscience, in which we do have certain very strong pressures, which sometimes are accepted and recognized, but often violated. We have no great and full explanation of the conscience process, but we are inclined to feel that what we call conscience today has to do with the individual violating some preconception upon which he has learned to lean, or the validity of which he has accepted. Therefore, conscience does not represent any spiritualized faculty, but merely the voice of his traditional acceptances. Psychology, however, does recognize the fact that the violation of conscience mechanisms will nearly always prove detrimental. They destroy a degree of integration within the person. They cause him to have less faith in himself. They cause him to feel less respect for his own nature. If he feels that he is transgressing some value which he holds to be real, he is disappointed in himself. And he also develops the fear mechanism, because conscience usually involves some machinery of punishment. The individual who goes against his conscience is opening himself to some kind of retribution which is not pleasant or to be desired. Now, conscience operates when we are awake, but we have every reason to suspect that it operates even more actively when we are asleep. For nearly all impulse and instinct are more powerful when the conscious mind does not modify their pressures. The conscious mind of man causes a focalizing of objective awareness. The individual becomes acutely centered in his objective nature. In this centering, he is exceptionally responsive to the visible and physical things around him, and very little does he respond to the invisible, superphysical things within him. Thus he lives objectively, and with very little recourse to the principles which lie locked within him. This brings us then to the elements or the chemistry of the psychic factor as it might be involved in dream phenomena. Question may be asked in the first place, does man know more when he is asleep than when he is awake? I would say that probably not, but that he is more aware of what he knows. In the waking state, the individual does not have immediate access to the various levels of his own subconscious. In other words, he cannot be consciously aware of the subconscious. About the only part of his internal defense mechanism that is available to him is memory. Memory can issue warnings, and does. Memory can remind him of the hazards of an enterprise, and will do so. But the individual frequently resists memory on the ground that each new situation is a unique thing, and therefore it cannot be explained merely by reference to previous experiences. Thus, the burglar who has been jailed twice may remember this, but it will not prevent him from making a third attempt to burglarize something on the ground that he now has perfected the perfect crime. Later, he will remember that this did not work either, but by that time, he will be planning upon a new course of procedure, which he believes will violate his expectancies of being caught. Thus, memory does not serve us in everything, but memory makes available a small part of our own previous experience. A very great part of that general experience, however, is not rememberable by any conscious process, and therefore only certain phases of our own dispositions can be reached by the memory technique. There are other parts which do not respond to this type of stimulation, for it must be the result of association mechanisms to bring memory into operation. On the level of the unremembered, there may also be a great deal of that which is truly known, but that we know not that we know. This, in turn, causes a series of experiences which occasionally come into our objective understanding. Here again, we have inspirational moments. Here we have sudden mystical stretches or spells or instants of insight. Something totally beyond the ordinary. Something that memory alone will not explain by normal procedure is suddenly known to us. Now, in this knowing to us, I believe there is another element that we have to bear in mind. It may have an effect upon the entire problem of learning from dreaming. Man's inner life is undoubtedly archetypal. And by that I now mean that it represents a pattern. Man's internal organization is built upon law. It is a formula, lawful in itself, and depending for its continuance upon obedience to basic laws of existence. Thus, inside himself, man is a law-abiding creature, even though in his outer personality he may be a law-breaker. Man mentally, even emotionally, seeks to outwit his own lawfulness. He finds innumerable excuses, and in the course of ages, the external tradition of man has deviated markedly from the internal record or report. The reason for this has been that objectivity, by the intensity of its processes, has come to be regarded as the final reality. And the problems that arise around us have precedence over the pressures that arise within us. If, therefore, as a result of tradition, heredity, indoctrination, and experience, each of these to a measure misunderstood, we arrive at a certain conclusion or a certain attitude, we may develop a total personality which is psychologically unsound. This personality may not be so considered either by the individual or by his associates, because he may live in a world in which this kind of unsoundness is prevalent. Most people being like himself, he considers his own nature to be normal. And in this sense of normalcy, he goes on breaking rules and laws imposed by nature because others break these rules and laws. And so society becomes an order of law breakers rather than of law keepers. Such laws as will bring with them immediate physical punishment, we are inclined to keep. But laws which affect us primarily on a psychic level, we neither understand nor appreciate, nor do we sense the need to obey them. This means substantially that the inner life of man may not condone his outer conduct, be entirely sympathetic with it, or recognize it as a best way of action. To meet this situation, man builds more and more rational defenses. He tries to convince himself. He psychologizes himself, or permits himself to fall under the hypnosis of prevalent attitudes. Now, hypnosis produces a susceptibility to suggestion. The hypnotized person must, to a measure, temporarily fulfill the wishes of the hypnotist. In the same way, a hypnotized society must fulfill the pressures or purposes or accepted procedures of that society. Once we assume the normalcy of a social pattern, this social pattern begins to influence us. It moves in upon us. It requires allegiance. It creates penetration by consistent repetition of its plan or its procedure. And today we take the child from its parent's knee, place it into the school. The school continues to indoctrinate that child with certain beliefs. These beliefs are carried through into higher education. They then proceed on onto the business level of life. Then the individual marries someone with the same beliefs. These are further intensified. The young people become parents and pass on these same beliefs to their children. And all the time, these beliefs are becoming more believed by the person who holds them. After a time, it seems that there is no other way, that there could not possibly be any justifiable conflict, that these things with which we have hypnotized ourselves have to be true, that they are the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And having taken this oath on the witness stand, we proceed to lie ourselves out of faith. We don't always intend to, but our witnesses under oath do not agree in their evidence. And the mere fact that we are even trying to be truthful does not help too much after we have forgotten how to be truthful. We are at a disadvantage all the way along. Thus we may build up two distinct levels of psychic entities. The outer level is dependent almost entirely upon outward circumstances, and it produces a more or less complete psychic being, created to obey the impressions and pressures around it. From this psychic being comes this kind of static drag that has been noted throughout human society. It causes the traditionalist. It causes the person who resists change, the dogmatist and the exclusionist. It causes the reactionary, and impels persons in various walks of life to lock their own ways away from other people. It leads to legislations to protect entrenchment rather than progress. And all through this procedure, everyone is doing what he believes to be right, but he does not know what right actually means. Now, you can go along like this, making a very choice, cultivated group of mistakes. He can go on breaking one natural law after another. And if his infringements are not too massive, he is very likely to drift through the years with only those general discomforts and inconveniences which he can blame on someone else. But actually, he is not living well. He is not being true to the rules of his own existence. He is betraying something inside of him while he is trying to protect the surface of his own consciousness. This situation frequently leads to the building up of pressure, the variations of the personality from the inner integration of life may become more pronounced. Attitudes that are detrimental may take over. The individual may find himself inundated in his fears and worries. He may find his natural optimism ebbing away. He may discover that his health is vanishing by degrees, and that he has not much longer to go before the general error of his ways will result in the disintegration of his mortal compound. This situation can and often does result in a desperate effort or a meaningful effort on the part of the archetypal consciousness to reassert itself over the life of this individual. I think we are safe in saying that while man, by himself in a forest, could not necessarily learn to read and write, that in this state of isolation, had he the proper faculties, he could gain a very profound knowledge of many values. He could become intelligent without becoming intellectual. In the same thinking, the individual living in the confusion of times and confusion of situations can become intellectual without being intelligent. Intelligence has something of integrity about it. Intellectualism has merely self-justification and the eternal desire to prove that we are right without very much incentive to make sure that we are right. If then we find a life going outwardly, contrary to its inward needs, I think we have learned from long observation and experience that nature will not permit this disaster without making some effort to correct the situation. If there seems to be no way in which the person can receive the necessary instruction as the result of his own ability to interpret value, this instruction is pressed upon him from within himself in some symbolic form, in some way which it is hoped or believed he can understand or accept. Sometimes this pressure is so great that it breaks through even in the hours of waking. But as the hours of sleep are nearly always available and represent a minimum of resistance on the part of this badly oriented personality, it is most common for these important recommendations to be impressed upon us in the form of dream symbols. The subconscious of man is not a structure that is capable of molding forms with its own hands. It has no voice as we understand voice. It does not speak as we understand speech. It cannot impress itself directly upon us because of its own nature, which is essentially formless. We have no actual ability to behold the face of integration. We do not know what it looks like, but we do recognize that it can be communicated or in one way or another made somewhat evident to us by means of symbols. Actually, we have no ability to understand any abstraction unless this abstraction is closed, is put into a likeness or guise which is comprehensible. It is impossible for us to draw a picture of virtue. The only way we can understand it is by means of examples, and examples are a form of symbolism. We use the example to indicate the principle, and in education today, the example method is still one of the dominant ways of imparting new ideas. Even a formula remains comparatively meaningless until an example is provided. So in our dream or thought process, any important message must be conveyed to us by means of materials supplied by our own psyche. Now, the psyche, which it is important to reach with this impression, is the objective one. And the symbolism of objective man is derived from the objective world in which he lives. He derives his symbols from things or relationships or conduct patterns. And by these patterns, he seeks to communicate virtues of one kind or another. In the days of the early church, when most persons were illiterate and only the clergy could read the Bible, religious instruction was imparted by means of pictures. The walls of the churches and chapels and cathedrals were ornamented with scenes from the life of Christ. These were explained by the priest or the deacon and became, therefore, pictures of quality. These pictures were enlarged to include the parables and the principal admonitions of Jesus, and were further complicated or enlarged by the production of miracle plays on the porches or the broad squares before cathedrals. Here, dramatically, the lives of saints, the various moral virtues, the victory of good over evil, the story of the prodigal son, or the tale of the Good Samaritan were enacted in order that the people might thus become aware through a simple symbol of the natures and substances of invisible virtues, which could not be directly traced of themselves. Thus, when some kind of abstract impulse is communicated from the archetypal psyche to the objective mind, there must be an adequate way of communication. Now, if we would assume that this subjective is a kind of ancient teacher, is the instructor, is the sage, or the saint, or the savior, the prophet, the priest, the philosophic physician, we can perhaps estimate what our reaction would be if some such a person should suddenly enter into our physical way of life. Supposing some very wise person made himself available to the needs of a very foolish man. The chances are the entire procedure would be utterly non-productive. The wise man would not be accepted by the foolish man. His wisdom would be regarded as old fogyish advice. He would be told that he belonged to a decadent generation, that the qualities which he tried to teach were old-fashioned and no longer applicable. The only way to live would be the very way which was causing the trouble. Thus, the direct admonitional procedure would be of very little value unless it was accompanied by something by which it was distinguished, by which it was set apart from common experience, and in which something stronger than words became the basis of the communication of ideas. Sometimes, therefore, your archetypal image will impress itself in the form of a vision in which a person, usually a celestial or sublime being, suddenly appears as though in actual reality, communicates the instruction, or gives the warning or the admonition and then vanishes back into the mysterious abstract regions from which it came. The impact of such an experience, visual and audible, upon the lower personality is much more profound by the very mystery with which it is involved. Such a visitation, so-called, could not be taken lightly. And the course of history has frequently been changed by visions of this kind. Yet the admonition given in the vision was not something entirely unknown to the person who received it. It was an admonition subconsciously known, internally recognized to be true, but ignored or willfully forgotten by the ambitious person who did not wish to be limited by the dictates of his own conscience. Thus, the question as to whether this type of visitation represents the addition of knowledge or merely the revelation of the known, a new degree of impression from that which is eternally true. This is a situation of psychological significance. There is another point that I think is interesting in connection with this, namely the so-called warning or instructive admonition. We know perfectly well that if a truly enlightened person was to thoroughly estimate our conduct, or if some now devised impartial mechanism, some machine which impersonally accepted all the factors of our personality into an equation, that such a machine could theoretically give us a fairly concise statement of our probabilities in a given situation. Also, we know that had we the wisdom enough, we could foresee things that would likely arise. We could avoid difficulties that are practically inevitable because of the course we are following. Yet these things are not evident to us in our normal state. Thus, the admonitional or instructive vision or dream does not necessarily mean that a foreign or outside entity is instructing. It can well mean that a deeper and better part of ourselves is providing us with a larger measure of insight into the probabilities of our own conduct than would be objectively possible. And because the universe is lawful, and because all conduct must have its consequences, there are many phases of prophecy which only represent recognition of cause and effect and their inevitable operation.